Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 2nd of June, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Morning, Phil.
Is it June already? Blimey.
Yeah, it is.
What's happening to this year? Whizzing by.
Yeah, I know. Ridiculous.
It is, and the sun's out in this part of the world, and it's lovely. Summer looks like it's coming.
Oh, excellent. Yes. So now we've got a special guest on this week, haven't we, to discuss a very topical issue. Do you want to introduce him, or shall I explain to our listeners?
Before that, could I?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
I don't know if I owe an apology to listeners, but we need a corrections and clarification section to this podcast because my brain doesn't always work properly, and people listening last week might have thought, what the hell's that guy talking? He doesn't know what he's talking about.
They think that every week, Phil.
Well, probably. But I have always, for completely unjustifiable reasons, I get muddled up between cement and concrete, which, as anyone knows, is like muddling up yeast and bread. I mean,
oh, yeah,
how you can confuse yeast and bread, I've no idea. But anyway, I was talking about cement piles and pouring wet cement. And, of course, I should have been talking about concrete. So
yes.
I hope that listeners will forgive my ignorance and stupidity, and I will try harder in future.
Well, I think it's a common failing. Most people, certainly most lay people, say cement and concrete and use the terms interchangeably, but you know, talk about cement mixer when they mean a concrete mixer. That's what
but we're meant to know better, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. That's true. Yes, there's no excuse. But I'm also I'm rather ashamed that when you mentioned who are the big cement producers.
Oh yes, I was trying to remember who it was.
Well, I managed to trot out the three leading cement producers who no longer exist, ceased to exist several years ago.
But I was talking about some rather fabulous offices, or a rather wonderful building, somewhere around the junction of the M25, A3, M3, A3, neck of the woods, and by a theme park, which they also owned. And I think we said Lightwater Valley or Chessington or something
like
it's actually
that.
Thorpe Park. And
that's the one.
Is the amusement park that they owned and were next door to. And the company, not cement company, concrete company, RMC, Ready Mix Concrete.
Right, there we are.
Which was subsequently taken over by Cemex, the big Mexican giant. And Cemex, I think, in more recent years, have sold these offices of RMC. But the offices which had a swimming pool in the lobby, sort of behind the reception desk, was RMC. So that was the name I couldn't remember last week.
Well, all cleared up now, thank goodness.
Clear as mud.
Well, anyway. Right. Sorry, Phil, what are you going to say?
Today, I was going to say, you're asking me about what we're talking about today and our guest.
Yes.
The issue I would like to explore today is the Construction Industry Training Board, which we've talked about. Do you remember, was it last month or the month before, we had the fabulous Peter Launer on, who's the chairman of the Construction Industry Training Board, to talk about the fact they haven't done a U-turn. He said they're tacking like a good sailer to adjust to the wind. That was in relation to them deciding not to sell a couple of their training colleges. It actually starts this month on the 14th of June. The consultation process starts, which is a legal obligation on a construction industry training board. Every 3 years, they have to have a structured and open consultation with the industry, the people that pay them the training levy, and to basically justify their existence. The CITB can only continue to collect the levy if periodically the industry says, yep, we approve. I've said before, in many ways, the CITB is a bit like the BBC, in that it's sort of a whipping boy, and everyone slags it off, but actually, what would we do without it, kind of thing?
Yeah.
And most people really would, they might want it to change and do things differently, but they support it, and they like it, and they want it to be there. The BBC, of course, doesn't have to ask us if we want to carry on paying the licence fee. That's just a given. At least the CITB does have to justify its existence. And this is called the consensus process, is the jargon for this. And it's supposed to happen every 3 years. It was supposed to happen, it was due to happen in 2020. But of course, COVID got in the way. And with lots of people on furlough and working from home and other things on their mind, it was agreed that they would postpone it by a year. And the government, the sponsor, is it the Department of Employment, I think, that sponsors the CITB, said, okay, we'll give you a pass for this year. Go ahead and you know, without having the consensus process that you're supposed to have, go ahead and collect it for another year. And the, I don't know if it's quid pro quo, but at the same time, CITB said, we'll cut the fees by 50% for 2020.
Yeah.
That's coming to an end. But there's going to be, they're proposing CITB for the period 2022 to 25, a 3 year period, the rate, levy rate will be the same as what it was 2018 to 2020, i.e. before the 50% cut. And there'll be some people who think, oh, great, now's our opportunity to tell everyone how much we hate the CITB. And no doubt we will be hearing from, I'm sure, our friends at Hudson Contract, who have been particularly vocal in talking about the CITB, saying it's anti-democratic and anachronism and not needed and blah, blah, blah. And they say they speak for the, you know, the smaller building company who are underrepresented and underheard. And they've done their own surveys to show that the large number of companies at the bottom of the pyramid aren't particularly fans of the CITB, or at least aren't fans of paying their levy. And so there will be those sort of voices. But today, we thought, didn't we, David, that it would be a good opportunity to let the CITB put its own case, to come on and say why the levy renewal and the continuation of the CITB should be allowed to continue. Let's give it a go ahead. Now, I dare say not everyone will agree, but let's give the CITB their say, yeah?
Yes, indeed. We can always get somebody else on to give the opposing view, I suppose. But I think it'll be quite enlightening, actually, to get it from the horse's mouth, as it were. I'd be interested in hearing the arguments myself.
And is the horse himself here yet? Do we have him? Is he? He's on his way, I think. I can hear the cantering of hooves.
Hi there, Steve. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. It's a pleasure.
Jolly good. I suppose there are no prizes for guessing that you'd like all our listeners to vote yes next month to your proposals.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that we've set out a business plan for this year in terms of what we're looking to do in terms of investing the levy. And now we have set out what the levy proposals are. I think the key thing is now we really want to have a good discussion over this 2 month period and really get industry to engage with it and to answer the question, which is whether they believe the levy proposals are necessary to secure adequate training in the industry. Rather an uninspiring statement, adequate training, but it is just the legal definition that we have to use.
Isn't that always the question when you do this three yearly exercise? Isn't that always the question you ask?
It's always the question, But what we have done this year, I think, is try to make it, in the consensus process, really obvious what the question is. So those companies that are, for example, taking part in the telephone survey, it'll be a very short survey with a very small number of questions. And I think the question that is about consensus really flashing up in light so people are absolutely clear why they're answering that question.
I mean, you don't normally get a massive response to the consultation, if I remember correctly. And of course, last year.
So I mean, the consensus process is there's a mixture of two parts. There's clearly the what are called the prescribed organisations, mm-hmm. to use another sort of bit of legal jargon. So these are 14 trade associations within the construction sector, covering a sort of mixture of sort of some very large ones like the Contractors and Specialists World of Build UK, and then more sort of smaller firm ones like Federation of Master Builders and National Federation of Builders, and then a lot of specialist areas like house building and fit out and a range of other ones in Scotland as well. And they represent about a quarter of levy payers. And then we do a survey. Now, the survey is set in a way that there's a quota of 4,000 employers that have to be interviewed and are set up to be representative of the industry by nation. So England, Scotland, Wales, and also by size of firm. And then they're actually selected randomly and anonymously. So we'll always get a significant number of companies taking part. That's what we pay the survey company mm-hmm. to do. And the prescribed organisations obviously put a lot of time and effort into getting their members involved in the process and inputting their views.
Steve, can I ask, when you're consulting, talking to the trade associations, how do you assess, how do you judge the relative weight, the relative voice of those different trade associations? For example, Build UK has got really not very many big contractor members, but those are big companies, lots of employees and lots of turnover, whereas the other trade associations which represent smaller numbers have got many, many more companies. Do they all have, is it like, you know, if Build UK say yes and FMB say no, for example, it's one all, or and how do you balance it?
So it's weighted. So
by money or people?
It's both. So for securing consensus, we have to get over 50% on two measures. One is in terms of the volume, the number of levy payers, and one is in terms of the value of levy paid. Now, when people submit their levy returns, they actually indicate which trade associations they're members of. So that gives us the information to be able to weight responses. And obviously, the weighting of responses varies by the number of members they've got and also by the value of levy paid. So, for example, you take an organisation like Federation of Master Builders. In terms of the number of levy payers, that will be weighted very heavily. They've got a lot of members. But in terms of the value of levy paid, it would be a bit lower because most of their members are very small, so that they're not paying that much levy individually. So that's where we do it. And I mean, effectively, what you find is that prescribed organisations, taken together, those 14 organisations, they account for about a quarter of the number of levy payers and just under half of the value of levy paid. And some are significantly weighted higher than others on that information.
It seems to me a critic might suggest that there is scope for you to make those calculations to your benefit, and that my understanding, my impression, is that the strongest support for the CITB comes from the big companies who pay the most money, mm-hmm. And they generally, I think get the most back out of it in support for their training programs, whereas the large number of smaller companies at the bottom of the pyramid is where perhaps there's more debate about the relevance or the role of the CITB. Is there any justification to suggest that the way you weigh up the votes is stilted towards the big companies, the big payers?
No, I don't think at all. And I am not sure that also I agree with your point about where the money goes. So in terms of how the results calculated and weighted, I think the first thing to say is that the largest share of it comes from the survey, both in terms of the value of levy paid and the number of levy payers. So in the number of levy payers, three quarters of it comes from the survey. And the survey is exactly set up to be representative of the industry. So that there's no scope for us to sort of change that in any way. I think also the picture's changed a bit. I think certainly a few years ago, the point you were making that actually if you compare the value of levy people are paying in and then what people are getting out of it, smaller firms certainly were getting less than their share. But I think recently, because of the last few years, a number of changes we've made. One, that greater share of our funding goes to apprenticeships, and apprenticeships tend to be delivered by smaller firms. And secondly, we've introduced new funding mechanisms such as the Skills and Training Fund for smaller micros. You're actually seeing small firms actually getting a greater share of funding back than what they put in levy. So I think the picture has changed quite a lot over the last few years. And I think that's been a sensible shift, because I think, you know, by and large, the smaller firms are facing the greatest barriers to invest in training. I'm not saying that there aren't challenges for larger firms, but the barriers are probably greater at the small end of the industry.
How big does an employer have to be before it qualifies to pay the levy?
Yeah, we've changed that a year ago, actually, when we were actually planning to go for consensus, and then we ended up with just this one-year levy order to tide us over. So we have something called an exemption threshold. So that below that level, you don't have to pay any levy, and that had been stuck at 80,000 for quite a long time.
That's the total salary or wage bill.
That's the total pay bill. Okay. Yeah. So we looked at the evidence in terms of what had been happening to pay, and we took soundings. We've got a levy strategy committee of members across the industry. And their advice to us was to increase that to 120,000. So that's gone up quite a lot.
Sorry, Steve. I need to interrupt. This may be a stupid question. 80,000 wage bill, that barely buys the CEO breakfast. Is that a weekly bill? Is that weekly or annually?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is it's meant to be based on sort of 3 to 4 employees, that type of thing.
But it's 80,000 a year, yeah, or 120,000 a year we're talking about.
80,000 a year.
Okay.
So it's gone up to 120,000. That in itself has taken a number of companies out of levy. Also, clearly, during the pandemic, we've seen companies, unfortunately, having to reduce their pay bill. So that has also taken more companies out of levy. So we thought it was the right thing to do. You know, I think obviously at the smaller firms struggle more to find this funding. So we thought it was sensible to take more firms out of levy.
Do the smaller firms avail themselves properly? Do they take proper advantage of the training available through the CITB? I mean, if you're a small building firm with, say, 3 or 4 employees, you've got to train your staff, but a lot of them will be trained on the job. And if you're building a house or an extension or something like that, maybe you can't afford to take too many people off the job very often in order to train them. So I wonder if maybe any dissent from the industry is sort of concentrated at the lower end of the pyramid, as it were, because people don't really get as much as they perhaps ought to get out of the CITB levy.
I think there's all sorts of challenges there. I think one is obviously we're working really hard to communicate to smaller firms about the support that's available. And that, you know, a lot of those firms can be really hard to reach, but we've put, I think, a lot more effort into that. And some of that clearly we'll be doing through trade associations that have got lots of small firms in membership. We've tried to take the bureaucracy out of Flaming Grant. I think we've made some progress on there. There's probably a lot more to do. And I think there's also some individual funds, such as the Skills and Training Fund, that are a fairly simple route for small firms to get funding. I think the next thing perhaps to look at is what we have seen during the pandemic is that because people have been forced to do this, that a lot more people are doing training online, which allows you to do it, you know, actually where and when you want to. Doesn't necessarily work for everyone or every area of training, but I think that might be something we want to sort of develop more of in the future. And I think that would help to address the barriers that people have in terms of finding the time to train, and particularly the barriers faced by smaller firms. I think the other thing I was going to say is that I think obviously one of the biggest areas of investment in skills right across the industry is apprenticeships. And most of that is done by small firms. They clearly face a lot of challenges. And what we try to do there, I think, as well as providing the funding support, is clearly we have an apprenticeship team which works very closely with learners and employers to really help them to deliver those apprenticeships and link them up with providers. So it is very challenging world for smaller firms, but I think there's a range of things we can do to help them overcome those challenges.
I know traditionally we associate CITB with traditional skills, bricklaying, plastering, carpentry and so on, or train operating, plant operating. I know that in recent years you also fund a lot of what Michael soft skills or management training and other skills which are required to run a successful business. Can I apply to the CITB for money for any sort of training? If I want to learn French, can I get some money from the CITB? Or do I have to justify it in a, you know, are there parameters and that I have to meet?
There are parameters. I mean, most of this funding you don't actually have to apply for. So most of this is provided through the grant scheme. And there are some clear criteria about what qualifies for that. What we did a few years ago was, I think we put more of a focus on actually construction skills. I think we were finding we were funding a lot of very generic things like Excel training and telephone training and induction training. We thought, well, is that actually really addressing the skill needs of the industry? So we have focused it much more on sort of things that are perhaps more at the trade level, but not entirely. But leadership and management is one area that we're looking at the moment. What we're trying to do there at the moment is agree with the industry, actually looking at probably roles, particularly at the site level, site supervisors, site managers, things like that, really agree with them a gold standard in terms of what are the key outcomes they're looking to achieve. And I think it's one of the things that it's not just about the amount of training, but it's about whether the training's effective. And I think at the moment, what happens in the industry is there's a lot of training that ends up being repeated because the outcomes aren't clear. So one of the things we are working on with leadership and management is looking to agree some common outcomes, what that training would achieve. So if you do it for Kier and then you go and work for Wilmot Dixon, there's clear evidence that you've got the skills that are needed. We're not dictating how companies do the training because that's up to them. But clearly, I think what is useful is for an industry to agree together about what are the outcomes we're all collectively trying to achieve.
And that's work in progress, you say?
That's work in progress. We're working with particularly some of the largest trade associations and a number of the others. And that's something we're going to be saying more on in the next couple of months. Mm.
Will that reach a conclusion? Is it something that's going to happen by
absolutely
by November?
Has to. Or I mean, we're looking to reach a conclusion on that in the next couple of months and then start to develop the programs that people can get behind. I think it's just really important that we've been looking to engage very, very closely with the industry in terms of developing this so it meets its needs. But absolutely, it's got to reach a conclusion.
But presumably the element of ongoing review of it the whole time, it would be a state of permanent review, I would have thought.
Of course, but I think at the same time, I think if you take those key roles, you can really look at what are the sort of key areas of skills, knowledge and behaviour that you're looking for. It may well be that over time some of these change, some of them become more important, or the bar raises in terms of what you're looking for from people. I think, you know, things like net zero and building safety, clearly post-Grenfell, are all going to create more demand. So I think the bar is continually raising. But I think the key elements that you're really looking for in terms of people's skills, knowledge and behaviour are probably common over time.
Steve, CITB is a fairly rare beast these days. There used to be, I think, several industry training boards at one time. And is the CITB the only one left, or are there a couple more?
No, we've got... A sister organisation, the Engineering Construction Industry Training Board, that's a bit smaller than us. I think probably has a smaller number of large members, whereas I think we've got this long tail of very small companies. But we're the main two. I think there's the odd sort of voluntary one as well. But there are very few organisations like us these days.
Well, I wonder why that is, because, I mean, I know that some people would say that CITB is a bit of an anachronism these days, but you've clearly got... there must be something about the construction industry which means that it needs a body like CITB. What are the criteria, do you think?
I think it's an industry that faces a number of barriers to training. I think it's a very fragmented industry, very much dominated by small firms. clearly there's a lot of people that aren't directly employed or aren't permanently employed, and I think those are all barriers to training. And I think there probably is a need for an organisation like ourselves that can take an overview of what the key skill needs are and prioritise funding in those areas and bring people together. It may well be that the industry changes and at some point in the future it can actually meet all the challenges it's faced on training itself, and you don't need an organisation like CITB, but I think at the moment it's needed. One of the questions we ask, actually, which is something we ask a couple of times a year of the industry, is whether people, employers, believe the levy and grant system is necessary to improve the quality and level of training. And that remains very high. And actually, I think at the time we did consensus last time in 2017, around about 2/3 of employees agree with that statement. That's actually gone up to 75%, just under 75% most recently. So I think the majority of companies in the industry believe this sort of approach is needed, and you need an organisation like the CITB. You certainly need a levy. That might change in the future, but at the moment, I think there's fairly limited evidence of it doing so.
The CITB itself has changed quite noticeably in the last couple of years, hasn't it? I mean, you're more of an administrative body now rather than, I mean, you don't deliver any direct training yourselves. You've sold off all but two of your...
Not remember, David, we had Peter Lauder last month or so ago. The CITB is staying in training now.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the general drift has actually been that we've moved out of a number of areas where we felt that other people were better placed to do it, or there were conflicts of interest. So we're no longer an awarding body. We don't administer the card scheme, and we have got out of some areas of training. Clearly, as Peter, our chair, said a few months ago, we've had to press the pause in terms of moving away from divesting of all of the training. But I think in general, the direction is for an organisation to be a lot more focused. I think more recently, certainly in terms of the strategic plan we developed, I think one of the things we're really looking to do is think, well, actually, if you look at the sort of the outcomes that the industry is looking for, which are the ones that are CITB's responsibility, and actually what should the industry lead on? So I think that is an area of change. So, for example, I think we put a lot of things on sort of the image of the industry and careers onto our shoulder and took responsibility for raising the favourability of the industry. Ultimately, I think our role in that sort of space is about actually ensuring there's good information on the opportunities in construction, how you get into them, what the progression routes are, and then addressing a number of barriers such as providing work experience and then providing information to employers in terms of how to improve culture and working practices and what other sectors are doing. Beyond that, actually, in terms of making construction a more favourable place, that's very much down to the industry to do it. So I think we're now being a lot clearer about actually where we can make a difference and where others such as industry or government need to lead. I think the other change, certainly, and it was a change we made during the pandemic, but we've continued into our plan for this year, is I think in the past we were maybe trying to do too many things. There were too many projects trying to cater to every single need for every bit of the industry. I think what we have now is a much simpler business plan where we're focusing on doing a smaller number of things and doing those well.
You mentioned the card schemes. I think that's an interesting one, because while it was always controversial, it seems to have at least been going in the right direction when the CITB were running them. And it seems to be chaos now, the card scheme system. I mean, there must be people in the CITB who think, maybe we should have kept hold of them.
I wouldn't necessarily say it is chaos, but clearly there have been some teething issues. But I do think that the fundamental question is, you know, an industry strategic body on skills, should it be running call centres and administration of those issues? I don't think that's a sort of a core thing that an organisation like ourselves should do. So I'd say absolutely was the right decision. Clearly, there have been some teething issues and those have been worked through, but I think it was still the right strategic call.
I think there'd be a lot of people listening who hope that it is only teething issues. I think the fear is that it's open heart surgery is needed, not a little bit of light dental work.
I'm not underestimating the challenges, and there's some important work that needs to be done to get that right. But I think still very much standing by that the decision was right strategically. Okay. I think one thing that's sometimes said about us is that we've moved away from being an organisation that's about training. But actually, if you look at our business plan for the year ahead, and you look at the funding we're providing through the grant scheme and other sort of funding routes, such as the Skills and Training Fund, the sort of projects we fund through that are related to training, such as training groups or travel and subsistence for apprenticeships and shared apprenticeship schemes, and also all the sort of support we provide in terms of helping companies deliver apprenticeships, that actually comes up to 85% of our spending. So this year we're going to be raising around about 140 million pounds in levy, and you can actually see around about 125 million plus is actually going on training. So I think sometimes some of the things we do, such as careers campaigns, get all the attention, but actually the great majority of funding goes on and supporting training in a variety of ways. So I think, you know, that is another real feature of our business plan for this year, that there is a greater focus on the training part, the T part of CITB.
Do you think it would make sense for the CITB to take the construction's apprentice levy as well? At the moment, we've got a situation where construction companies, they pay the apprentice levy to HM Revenue and Customs, and they pay the construction levy to the CITB, and yet they're basically for the same thing, it seems to me. Okay, it's not just apprentices of CITB money, but that's the driving force, I suppose. Do we need these two things happening in different directions? Can't they come together?
I think it does make life complicated, and it is something that potentially could be looked at. I mean, I think if you look even at apprenticeships, the apprenticeship levy, it does cover different things from CITB. So the apprenticeship levy is there to actually pay the cost of training that's provided by the colleges. So it covers those fees that were previously paid for by taxation, by the Exchequer, whereas our support on apprenticeships is actually sort of all the other areas of training in terms of the time costs that employers are putting into apprenticeships. But I agree, I think for some companies, they might well feel that it would be more sensible to combine the two. I think even if that doesn't happen, I think what we can do and what we're talking to government about at the moment is actually what can be done to get the apprenticeship levy funding to the employers that need it most. And clearly there is this sort of distinction between the apprenticeship levy, which is paid mainly by large firms, and apprenticeships in construction, which are mainly delivered by smaller firms. So one of the things we are working with the government on at the moment is, this, there a simpler mechanism where you can get the unspent levy funds to those employers that are looking to invest in apprenticeships? And that's certainly something I think we're going to hear announcement from the government on in the next couple of months. But I think it's really good that that's getting some attention. I think there may well be other things in the apprenticeship maybe that need focus, but it's really good to see one area that has been causing problems is getting increasing focus.
So you've got the consultation now running from the middle of this month until is it the end of August it runs, or?
That's right. It starts on the 14th of June and finishes on the 15th of August, what does that mean? That means by that date, the 14th. Prescribed organisations, those trade associations, will have come back to us to tell us their view, and we'll have the results of the survey. We'll then be reviewing the results. We talk to our board about it, and clearly we have to talk to government. We're looking at the moment about making an official announcement early October, but I think last time around in 2017, we were able to make a more unofficial announcement in September. And I think clearly, if things go to plan, we'd hope to be able to say more on that in September rather than waiting till October. But there is a sort of process with government we have to go through, which means it isn't overnight from the middle of August to announcing the results. Right. But we'll do it as soon as we can.
Of course, you've already done a sort of a preliminary exercise. You went out to industry to sort of test the water back in March, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we tested the water in terms of what the proposal should be in March. And we actually did an exercise in the previous year when we, you know, in March 2020, mm-hmm. when we thought we were going to be going for consensus before the pandemic hit. So we've had two levels of engagement with the industry in terms of what the levy proposals should be. The key thing from last year was, I think there was a real preference for increasing the threshold. So it took a number of companies out of the levy. And I think this year, the proposal was very much to keep the levy as it is. I think we felt, and certainly the Levy Strategy Committee of Employers felt, that now wasn't the time to be imposing any change in industry in terms of the levy, or, you know, creating winners and losers if you changed rates and things like that. So it seemed very sensible at the moment to have stability, and that was certainly what got support in the consultation. So we're going out with something this year which is a sort of continuation of the levy as it is now. What we are starting to do, though, is we're working with a group of employers to do a more fundamental look at the levy in terms of the scope of it, in terms of whether it should continue to be a payroll one, whether we should try to collect it in real time in the future, and also learn from what other countries do on it. So although we're looking at very much status quo at the moment in terms of the levy, we are also looking more fundamentally about what the levy might look like in the longer term, and that might affect the next levy down the line in 3 years ahead.
Okay. Whew. any more questions, Phil?
I think you've covered it, Steve. Mm. But I think we'd invite you to, in conclusion, give us a 30-second elevator pitch, two sentences. Why should people vote yes?
Well, I think the levy is still really important to the industry. I think we've seen through the pandemic that it actually helped companies in a number of ways, helping more people to complete their apprenticeships, more learning going online and more accessible, key things like mental health being addressed. And we now have a strategic plan which is really focusing on the barriers and challenges that companies face in terms of making it easier to bring people into the industry, to deliver more apprenticeships, and also upskill people that are in the workforce already. So I think we have a plan there that is very much in line with industry needs, will help industry to meet its immediate needs in terms of skills, but also invest in the emerging skills that will help it to modernise and be more productive. So I think the levy is there really to make some key investments to support the industry on skills.
Great stuff. Yeah. We'll pretend that was 30 seconds.
I thought it was very concise.
It was.
I'm sure you can edit out some of the ums and ahs and get it to 30 seconds.
There were no ums and ahs. It's very fluent, Steve.
Well, look, I think that's great. You've made a very strong case, I think, Steve, and expressed it very eloquently. So if we do get anybody on the podcast to give us the alternative view, it'd be interesting to see how they couch it. But I think so far, CITB has put forward a strong case. Obviously, we've been through an extraordinary period over the last year or so. And I suppose it's given everybody a chance to reflect on how we run this industry. So good luck with the consultation. And well, we'll see in October what the result of all that is.
Yeah. Nice speaking to you both.
And to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Do you have a view, David? I know you don't have a vote, but how would you vote?
I think, well, maybe I'm just easily, just a pushover, but I think after hearing what Steve had to say there, I would definitely vote yes. I think he's quite right when he says that the construction industry, by its nature, needs a body like CITB. And I know that, you know, the levy system isn't perfect, and I still think there must be lots of small companies out there who are paying the levy and not really getting the full benefit of that. But nothing's perfect, and at least it sounds like the CITB is addressing issues such as that. So I think I would, yeah, definitely vote yes for that. What about you?
Well, rather like you, it sounds. I'm a great one for agreeing with the last person, yeah. I listened to, which makes, you know, I don't watch Question Time anymore because it's like, oh yes, they're right. Oh no, they're right. But my while I think the CITB has clearly dropped some clangers over the years, and it's such a shame that it. I understand that it felt it shouldn't be doing the card scheme, but I think that it should have more carefully thought out what it was doing with it before basically chucking it in the bin. So it's a shame that the card scheme is such a mess. It needed greater care, but that doesn't mean say the CITB should not exist. And we had Nancy Kerr on the other week, and to quote another of favourite singer Joni Mitchell, "You never know what you got till it's gone." And I think that would be very much the case with the CITB.
Yeah, I think so. So it'd be interesting to hear if any of our listeners have a different slant on that one. I'm sure there are people out there who have very strong views in both directions.
I suspect podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk will be inundated with people saying it's a bloody lefty compulsory tax. Why should we have to do this? We can do it our own, thanks. Let the free market do it. And there'll be a lot of that.
Well, I hope so anyway. Yeah, let's have the emails, yeah.
But other than that, I think that's our one and only topic for this week. Normally we like to talk about a few things, but we thought this was a sufficiently important issue to go to town on it this week. So come back to us next week, everyone, and we will find something different, more other things to talk about, as per usual. But for this week, it's been David and myself, Phil Bishop, with Reconstruction. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.